All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We're going to get started. A quick heads up, we are doing the power hour first, then an hour of general questions. So lots of opportunity to get through. If you've got a question, a comment, a topic, whatever it is you want to talk about, go ahead and press one on your phone right now. If it's a power hour question, we'll get to you in this first hour. If it's a general question, we'll get to you in the second hour. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it, we'll talk about it. All you have to do is pick up the phone and call us. Today is the Power Hour. We're going to take your engine-related questions, everything about troubleshooting, modifying, grading, performance, fuel mileage, you name it. Joining me, John, Ethan, and Bruce from Pittsburgh Power. So let me get all those guys in here. Hey, guys, welcome back.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
Well, great to have everybody here. Sounds like everybody survived the Great American Truck Show.
We did. We had a wonderful time. Met some new people. Met a lot of our wonderful old people from older clients from Texas. It's a great show because everybody's always so polite and well-dressed down there, and the double starch shirts and the cowboy hats and cowboy boots. And we stayed at the Omni and just met a lot of great people. Very, very good show for us.
Good, good. It was, the show was kind of small this year. It was a little more quiet than normal, not nearly as crowded, but in some ways, and I think you guys experienced this as well, sometimes the quiet shows are a little better. At a busy show, I have so many people that, you know, you try to talk to, you can't get to everybody, you feel a little rushed. So this was actually kind of nice. It was a little more relaxing. You had more time to spend with people.
That's correct. We stayed pretty busy. And we're very happy with the outcome and glad to be back, though. The weather's a little cooler up here.
Yeah, we're still in Texas. Well, technically, right now, we're right across the line in Oklahoma. We are scouting out a potential new CMC location.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. You'll have to call me sometime and talk to me about that.
We may know something this afternoon. We've got to get the CMC launched. Normally we've already got it announced and dates picked out. This is the first year in a while that we're just looking at some other possibilities. As the program grows, as we're doing more things, we're just looking for some potential locations. So I'll let you know how that goes. So, what's new and exciting over at Pittsburgh Power this week?
Well, we've been doing a lot of engine cleaning with the engine flush system that we had a year ago at the CMC. And John's seen some wonderful results. John, do you want to talk about that?
Yes, definitely. That is a really, really nice system that we've got there. Amazing to me the amount of dirt it pulls out of the engines. I'd like to talk to some of the drivers who've done them, get back to us with your oil analysis reports. I'm curious to see what we find after the flush, but it's a great program.
We pulled out of an ISX. Tell them how much soot we scraped out of that intake, how big that ball was.
Do you remember how much that was? Was it 70 grams or something it weighed?
Just about there, yeah.
It was 70 grams, which equated to about size of a good size peach, let's say, in a ball of carbon. It was pretty amazing. We've got some pictures of it. I think we'll put that in it'll make it to our website. Eventually, we're going to do a page on our EGR maintenance and our after-treatment maintenance. But we've documented one of those whole programs that we do, cleaned all the carbon out of the pieces that we are able to clean it out of, and captured it, and just to show you what we get out of there, and about 250,000 miles of running.
That's a lot. That's a lot of soot.
It really is. Yeah. So if you balled it up in your hand, like I said, it'd be about the size. Not quite a baseball, a little smaller. But, yep.
Wow.
And like I said, we weighed it on the... we used the scale that we use for balancing the connecting rods and pistons to weigh it. And it's significant. It definitely is.
Do we also tell them who we're doing dyno testing for currently right now?
Yeah, we've got an interesting program going on right now with Delphi injectors. It looks like we'll be selling their injectors in the future as well. They've got some new injectors. Right now we've got some Cat C12 stuff they're working on. So they're using our facilities, our dyno, and our FMU, our fuel management, to measure some efficiency and see what the consumption is at specific powers. And the fellow who's here is also generating all the trim codes as well. So he's trying to make the engine run nice and smooth and generate the trim codes to go with the injectors. And it's an interesting deal. Ethan's been working with him all morning. He can maybe give you a bit more of a rundown on that. But really, really happy to be working with those guys. And they're quite interested in our facility, the emission test equipment, as well as the engine dyno. So they may plan an engine here that we can and come back and forth with different injectors and so forth to work with there.
Yeah, and at the moment, we're taking a baseline of the horsepower. And then we're going to pick, I believe it's 3 points, idle 40 or 50% engine load, and then 100%, and take some fuel consumption numbers, swap the injectors, do it again. And we have 3 sets of injectors we're trying this week.
Right. It's really, really kind of boring baseline testing. You have to do a whole lot of work where you don't seem like you're doing much. So you generate really good numbers and make sure your numbers repeat, and then make sure they repeat again. And then you make a change and do it all again. So we'll be doing that all week for them. And maybe beyond, hopefully.
And Kevin, are you familiar with Delphi?
I think, is this the Delphi, the kind of automotive supplier that provides just ungodly numbers of products?
That's the Delphi, yes.
The Delphi, yes.
Didn't this used to be the AC Delco brand of General Motors parts years ago?
I believe that Delphi was a conglomeration that absorbed that. I think that Delco Ramey, I believe at one point, got lumped into a Delco portion, got yanked into Delphi. I think Ramey still exists, but the part that was Delco is now part of Delphi.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I used to have a pretty lucrative run for a while from one of the Cleveland suburbs, I forget what it was, over to one of the Detroit suburbs, and it was big spools of copper wire for Delphi for a lot of the stuff they did. So I'd run the wire over, and I'd bring the spools back, and then I'd run the wire over and bring the spools back. It was a really nice paying run, too.
And that was probably from the Packard wire plant, I bet, over in Warren. That was where all the GM.
You are absolutely correct. It wasn't Cleveland. It was the Packard plant in Warren. That's right.
Yep. That's a big plant.
Yeah. That was a great run. I was doing that for a while. I loved that one. It paid well.
John, do you want to touch on our remote tuning?
Yeah, I'd love to. We've got, as we've announced last week, T&E is going to be working with us. They've got their tuning package is in my office right now, waiting to be sent out. Leroy finished it up the other day, so it's ready to go to them. So they should be online with us here shortly. We've got a fellow in Chicago as well who's not quite ready. He's a small fleet operator, which is maybe going to be more of a market for this than I realized. So we're going to do some of his work on his personal vehicles, some of the fleet trucks first, and then he's going to be ready to take customers here sometime in the next month or two. So if you're in the Chicago area and need a little bit of a tweak on your tune or something, so if you got a check engine light we need to take care of or an after treatment issue, we'll be able to diagnose it, without you coming the whole way to Pittsburgh. Then we're also looking at a fella in Texas that Bruce met at the show I talked to for quite a while last night. Is very interested, so it looks like we may have one in Texas. and I've got another one in Phoenix. And we just had a call this morning from the state of Washington. So hopefully we'll have all corners of the country covered soon. So you'll be able to have some Pittsburgh power tuning and diagnosis done, you know, without coming the whole way here. So that's progressing rapidly.
Well, speaking of the corners of the country, how would you like Orlando?
Orlando would be terrific. I would love to have someone in Orlando.
They have a great shop in Orlando, an independent shop that I used for years when I was down there, and I know the owner personally. He's a good friend of mine, so we'll have to get that set up.
Yeah, give me a call or Leroy a call. We've got an email packet that we send out now that's got describes the whole program and gets into all the detail, and we've got that ready to go. As soon as if you give us a ring and give us an email address, we'll get it right out to him.
Good, we'll do.
Let's not forget. Let's not forget Mimi and Randy being on the road with the unit also, and they spend a lot of time between Florida and Texas.
Yep, yeah, I can't forget them.
All right, good stuff. Let's get to a break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to get right to your call and question. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Today is the Power Hour, and we're going to get right to your calls and questions. We're going to start off in Michigan. Noah, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's good to be here. I had a question. I don't know if Pittsburgh Power has done any any work with the propane injection systems at all or not?
We have. In the past, we got a test truck set up, got a propane system this one company was offering. I don't remember their name at the time. And what we did some dyno testing and emissions testing on it. Overall, we don't find big benefit there. It's hard to find a place to fill the propane tank, because we had a 30-gallon tank mounted on it, and most places don't accommodate a Class 8 truck driving up to it and filling up. And he was a local guy, and he found that to be very difficult. And that the truck had a couple issues later on, too. So you got to be careful with that.
Okay. Kevin. I didn't know on the because the truck that we were thinking about putting it on has a Pittsburgh Power box on it already, and I didn't know for sure if that would even be feasible or not.
It does make a little bit more power. You do have to inject a lot of propane, though. I mean, think of the size of the engine we're dealing with here. This was a Cat we were on, so 15 liter. And at idle, it actually made the emissions worse because you're injecting too much propane. So you have to find that perfect balance to burn it all. Otherwise, you send emissions through the roof.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you got to be really careful with that.
I was thinking it would actually clean up the emissions some.
Well, if you inject the proper amount at the proper time.
Okay.
And that tends to be the trick, because most people just want to fog it into the intake, and you actually have to account for what engine load it's under, what altitude you're at. Also, how much power you're outputting.
Okay.
What else has been done to the truck? I mean, it's not just toss it on and you're good to go.
Okay.
So Noah, just to let you know, I did a really extensive a 60-day test altogether. We did our normal fuel mileage testing for 30 days prior to putting on the propane system. The company came down to our location, installed the system, and we gave them access to the truck every day. And we checked fuel economy and propane economy every day at the end of the day, because this was a dedicated run out and back. And we controlled the propane delivery every day. We checked fuel mileage at the end of every day and propane consumption, and we let the company tweak the system over and over and over. They could tweak it as much as they wanted. And the best fuel economy improvement we got, we did see a fuel economy improvement of 0.8 miles per gallon at the best. The problem was that was one of our worst cost effective settings. We had the best fuel economy, but the worst performance. The propane was expensive, and we were buying it cheap locally. So the fuel economy went up, but the overall cost went up as well. So we tried everything. I mean, we let them tweak the system over and over and over, and we could never get it to the point where it was cheaper to run propane and diesel. Diesel alone was always the cheapest way to run the truck. We tried everything.
Okay. So you actually, so it actually increased your cost instead of reducing it.
It increased cost. Yeah. It increased fuel mileage. And like I said, 0.8, that was pretty impressive. But the whole point is you're trying to lower cost. And that was actually, we were getting our propane delivered locally for like $1.99 a gallon. And at the time, Flying J was $3-something. And that's, you know, if you're on the road with a Class 8 truck trying to do propane, you're going to end up buying it at Flying J. And the prices are just high there. You can't get into most of these local places, or they can't accommodate filling up a big tank on the truck, or they're not open, you know, other than normal business hours. And $1.99 was about the best price we were going to find anywhere. And it still wasn't cost effective.
Wow. Yeah, I guess I was more interested in, I would have thought it would help with the emissions, clean up the emissions a little bit, but according to, was it John?
Ethan gave you that info,
Ethan.
But.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So it actually does not, because a friend of mine has been running it for years and he swears by it, but I know he doesn't crunch his numbers like Kevin does. he thinks he gains quite a bit every year by running the propane, but he also seems to think that he doesn't see near as much soot in his oil. He can run his oil longer and he doesn't get as much black smoke since he's been using the propane. But so that's not really something you guys have found.
Well, the only place we saw the increase in emissions was at idle. So going down the road, it very well could be. It will definitely be burning less diesel fuel. So there's some truth to that.
Yeah.
So
okay.
There are points on the curve where the emissions are probably going to be a touch less. That's not and the less soot in the oil, I can understand that as well. Yeah.
It's all about fine-tuning the system.
Yep.
And again, Kevin gave them 30 days to do it there, 60 days. And they still didn't quite get it dialed into the point where it was, you know, overly profitable to go ahead and, you know, start putting these on all your trucks.
Okay. Yeah, I figured there's got to be something. It's got to be something, or you'd see more fleets doing it. But I didn't know if it was more complicated. I can kind of see. Oh, go ahead.
As far as the tuning tweaking goes, we were same truck, same driver, same run, same weight, same weather, everything. That 30 days was really consistent. And if they couldn't tune for that specific run in 30 days, what are they going to do in an operation where you're changing altitude, weight, weather conditions? All these things are changing constantly. And they couldn't get it dialed in for us. I just don't think that it's really cost effective. But even to address the soot, you know, if he believes that he's really putting less soot into the oil, he may be, but I don't think he's testing it right to really know. But even if he is, I review thousands and thousands of oil samples every year. it's less than 1% of trucks where we change oil because the soot has gotten too high. Less than, I don't even think it's a tenth of 1% of all the oil samples I've ever looked at that I've had to say, you need to change this oil because there's too much soot. That almost never happens. We change the oil for lots of other reasons, you know, viscosity or wear metals or fuel or whatever, but almost never because of soot.
Okay. Okay, well, that answers my question. I appreciate it. Thanks for all you guys do.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Georgia. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I've got some work done on the motor there at Pittsburgh Power. They did a tune on the ECM, and I had some issues with my power box, and I'm headed back up there in another couple of weeks to get that straightened out. But I also had my transmission replaced a month ago, and they put a straight 10-speed in it. That's got, well, actually, it's an overdrive 10-speed. So the overdrive is like a 0.74 or 0.074, and it just, it doesn't pull with the crap, you know, because of the such a large gap between the RPM ranges, between 9th and 10th. And I have a gentleman that does a lot of transmissions down in Mississippi. He's telling me he can give me a 13 or an 18, and he's recommended an 18 speed because I got a 336 rears. I don't really want to go with an 18. What would y'all's, John or Kevin, what would y'all's position be on that?
Well, let me jump
ahead,
in
Kevin.
Here, because that advice kind of makes me wonder what the hell this guy's thinking. A 13-speed and an 18-speed, virtually identical on the top end. It's only the bottom end that's different. Who the hell wants to split the bottom gears anyway, unless you're really heavy haul? And you actually are going to split the bottom gears, which is pretty unusual. So a 13-speed would be better than the 10, would give you half the RPM jump when you can split the gears. But I always wonder what somebody's thinking when he makes the recommendation for the 18-speed. Two things come to mind. He either doesn't understand the transmissions, which I have a hard time believing, or he's just trying to sell you a more expensive transmission, which bothers me.
Yeah, I think it's the latter.
Well, hey, John, how's this thing running otherwise?
Let me get to a break, John. We'll get to you right after this and let you comment on that. The 13-speed I can see. So if you just replace the transmission, doing it again seems a little bit extreme. But we'll talk about that when we get back. Stick around. I'm Kevin Ruff. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. We're talking with John in Georgia, and we're going to get back to that. And, John, I'll let you jump in. You know, what do you think about the 18-speed? You know, I'd like to find somebody who actually has an 18-speed and drives it like an 18-speed because, you know, it's just not that often you're going to split those gears on the bottom half of the transmission. Let me find Ethan. Oh, there they are. All right.
Yep.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah, you really don't need, unless you're hauling really heavy, there's really not a whole lot of use for it. I've spent some time, you know, one of my things as a race engineer is I get to pick the ratios from the gearbox to the different tracks. So I understand ratio charts and things very well. So I've spent a whole lot of time since I've been here studying them all, and Eaton's got them all available on their website. They've got a great big Excel spreadsheet with every model of transmission and every speed and every ratio in it. And it's kind of interesting. And the 13s, they're all pretty much the same. They all start the same at the bottom and go to the same at the top with you know, fewer stops in between, I guess. And the 13 over the 10 speed is huge. We found one. Bruce found a number of a converted 10 speed that was interesting in that it was converted to a 13 speed that had a much lower first and reverse, which was would be ideal for a 264 conversion. And I've got the number written down somewhere, but unless you're hauling heavy, there's zero reason to put the 18 in there. You don't have any use for that at all. You just wouldn't even split the bottom side. And the top side's identical to the 18, so there's no real difference at all. Most of these transmissions all do have the same ratios throughout. But you would have one in between your 9th and 10th, basically. So your 11, 12, and 13, would you'd split that in half, would make life a whole lot easier for you in the top.
Okay, yeah, because like I said, with that, the reason he was saying three of the 18 speed was his reason was with that 336 rears, it would pull better. But if they're going to be the same at the top, that's where I'm having a problem because I got.
Yeah, again, unless you're hauling really heavy and you need to go split those gears on the bottom, you don't really need to do that.
Here's what I have a hard time understanding. When he says because of the 336s, the 18 speed will pull better. But here's the thing. Once you understand the transmission, you either have 13 different ratios that you can match against that 336 to pull in any situation you want, or you have 18. Well, we don't need 18. I mean, it doesn't pull better. Once you get into the top end, they're the exact same ratios. That I guess that's what bothers me is I hate taking advice or buying something from somebody who deals with transmissions and doesn't understand them.
Yeah, I agree. Yep,
yeah,
I agree.
I drove a 18, 10, 12 years ago, and I did not like it because it was just too many gears. Like, well, I never used the bottom
exactly.
Gear set.
You'd be in that same situation again, even with the 336. We've got guys who have no problem with the 264 and a 13 speed. So that wouldn't logic does not work out.
Yeah, John, I love the
idea. Yes, because I asked Pete about the 264 rear on his 10 speed, and he said that the only problem was it was so much money. You know, where this guy, he's taking my relatively new transmission. Like I said, I only had it a month. He's taking it out and doing an exchange for $500 for the 13, whereas he wanted like $1,800 exchange on 18 speed.
Right. I would do that deal in a heartbeat. Yeah, that would not for $500. That's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So hey John, how's the truck running otherwise? The tune we put on it, okay? I know it's not quite what the power box was, but you running all right?
Yeah, it's going real well. I have a little issues with temp still.
Okay.
But that's just, you know, I'm running. I've had a couple of back-to-back runs where I'm grossing out right at 80,000.
Okay.
You know, so. And to that, I don't know if you remember or not, but I had to 3 months ago break down out in Denver, and they put a new radiator in, and it's a smaller radiator. So that might be part of the problem I'm having with the temp, you know. But it is showing on the exhaust temp. But the as soon as I let out of it, the exhaust temp comes back down. But it's pulling
right.
Strong.
Good. Well, we'll play with next time you're in when you come in for the to get your power box squared away. We'll take care of that too.
All righty. Yeah, I hope to be in next Thursday or Friday. I got a load coming up to Bedford. I'm emptying out at the Walmart distribution center there in Bedford, Mass. I mean, Bedford, PA, Thursday morning. So hopefully be over there Thursday afternoon.
Sounds good. Look forward to seeing you.
All right. Yeah, I'll call Eric and get an appointment set up.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
So Kevin,
you
were going to ask about that transmission number?
Yeah, I was going to say I want to get that transmission number from you. You can send it to me in email or text because that
I'll email that to you. Yeah.
Oh, the one I have is RTO 16210C.
Okay. I'll look that up. I'll see what it becomes when you turn that into a 13-speed. You may have the correct one, but there is one 10-speed that had, and Bruce knew the number. Bruce, I think we lost Bruce. He had an appointment to get to for this particular gearbox, and I looked it up, and I'm like, it's got all the low stuff, you know, so if you need to back a 264 up to a dock or something, it's got the lower reverse, and it's got the lower first gear as well, and it goes to the same place. Once you convert it to the 13-speed, it goes to the 0.78 overdrive. Which is, I think it was 0.78. So it had the full range, you know, bigger drops in between, but I think that, you know, we make enough horsepower with all our stuff to deal with that just fine. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. But I'll get those numbers.
Yeah, that's another thing I don't like about this transmission because the bottom five, when I'm in sixth gear, when I get up to fifth gear, it's topping out at about 11 miles an hour. And I'm changing from fifth to sixth. I'm only going about 11.
That's interesting.
Wait a minute.
So that may
say that again.
You might have the right one.
From fifth to sixth gear, you're at what speed?
11 miles an hour.
He's got the one we're talking about. That's the one that would be great with the 264s, if we could get the overdrive onto it too.
I was going to say, that's got to be a really low end.
Yeah, that's a really low end. There's just one of them that has it. Yep. I'll look that up. John, I'll give you a call. You might want to just have yours converted. Just get that auxiliary box put on yours and turn it into a 13-speed, and you could be set.
Okay, yeah, I was thinking that, but I'd been told that I couldn't do that with mine.
So, but I'll give you a call.
Yeah,
I've got your number in the system.
Okay.
I'll give you a ring. Okay?
All righty. Good deal.
Right.
Thank you, John.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Yep.
Hey, Kevin, can you hear me? This is Bruce.
Oh, there he is.
I can.
Yeah. Okay. I'm in a vehicle right now, and it's going through the radio, so I can hear you.
You actually sound pretty good in that situation,
okay,
Bruce. Next time you're here, we might have to have you go out and sit in your car. That sounds better than when you're in the other office.
Okay. I was going to mention about those 336 gears, but I think everybody knows how I feel about 336 gears.
Hey, Bruce, do you remember the number of the converted 10-speed, what that one's called? You and I looked it up.
I'd have to go back to my pages of notes.
Okay, I'll find it. It's on my desk somewhere, too. I think I've also got it.
Yeah, I would like to get that because that's really and even with the other transmissions going to the 264s or the 279s, we don't have a huge problem, but it does require a better driver. If you get in one of those spots where you're really heavy and you've got one of those deep docks trying to get in or out of it, it would be nice to have that lower gear set down in the bottom and still have that same top end.
Yeah, I think it would be a perfect setup.
Absolutely. So we'll get that number. Now, I've always thought, and, you know, sometimes the difference between a 9 and a 10-speed can get really confusing. I've always thought that all the convertibles were 9-speeds. Is that not correct?
I'm not sure about that. Maybe it was a converted 9-speed then. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think the convertible. Now, there's some models that are really easy to convert. They're sold as convertibles, and they switch over easily. And I thought those were all nine speeds. But let me get to a break. Hold on, and we'll come right back with more stuff. Kevin Rutherford.
Too often to a loop there. Someone had a
conversion. Oh, yeah, that's pretty changed, yeah.
He had like a direct 12
years. Okay, it should be 11 normally, right?
This was different. He explained to me why. Okay. You knew what you're talking about.
Right.
I was in there, I'm like, yeah.
That was it?
That's it. I was like, I'm not going to argue with you. The numbers come out right. It all looks right. Too often to a loop.
Hey, John, you're not muted. All right.
Oh.
Well, hold on, guys, because I am having a technology issue with Blog Talk again. They've been doing a lot of upgrading on their system, and it's not working out so well for me. I am not able to get to my call board, and when I wasn't able to drop or add any calls. So let me see what I can do with this thing. All right, I think I've got it. So let's go ahead and do another segment. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I've got John and Ethan and Bruce with me. We're doing the Power Hour today. We are going to head off to Ohio. John, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello.
It's your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a question. I have a 2009 Kenworth T660 with a 400 ST Cummins in there. And I recently had it down at the Inland Kenworth down there in Phoenix, Arizona, because I was getting poor fuel mileage. And they went in and they advised that I had the DPF cleaned. And when they opened it up, they said that it was breached. So what they advised was that they replace it. And also they advised that I get an upgrade done on the vehicle because I complained of the power not being up to where it should be, that I thought. I haul a lot of light loads. I'm a furniture mover. And nothing over 30,000 pounds, and I'm getting terrible fuel mileage and power going up these hills in California and such. It's got a 264 rear end with a 10-speed automatic transmission, the Eaton Fuller combination, and I had it upgraded from the 400 to the 475. But since I did that, they could only do it with the program from Kenworth to give it 1,650 pounds of torque through the drive shaft over to the rear ends. Now, what it's happening is there's a grinding noise there in that transfer. And I don't know whether or not that's too much torque to get back through that drive shaft. And we need to go back to the original RPMs, the torque that's supposed to be made for that, or whether or not we keep it there. I may need to go up in horsepower, and I'm over here in Akron, Ohio, not too far from Pittsburgh Power. I was wanting to know your guys' take on whether or not I should bring it over there and have you guys put more power to the engine or just swap out those rears altogether and give me like a lower end ratio, like a 318 or something like that. I mean, I'm going 35 miles an hour up these hills. What do you guys think?
Yeah. Well, let me start, then I'll let the engineers come in. I don't think you have too much torque for your drivetrain. That's not the noise, number one. Number two is the gears are not your fuel mileage problem. It's going to be in the settings and the DPF, and I'm going to let John and Ethan talk about that.
Yeah, well, you need to figure out what the grinding noise is. It seems as if there's already some damage done of some sort. That transmission should be able to handle that amount of torque. That shouldn't be over the top for that.
Yeah, we've set them up in the past.
Yeah, we go a lot higher than that without issues.
Yeah, 1650, that's kind of on the low end there.
That is on the low end, yeah. We quite often from that engine will get over 2,000 pound-feet of torque at the wheels. And I know we've had them coupled to that transmission before, too. So that's not, I don't believe that's the issue. So what you need to do is get over here and have us do one of our EGR and after-treatment system maintenances on it. Make sure everything's working properly and you're not in some sort of D-rate. So it sounds to me as if you are. And the Cummins will do some silent D-rates. So it'll pull power out of it without you even knowing it. So I think you may be in one of those situations, especially if you've had other people messed with that with the EGR system.
How many miles are on a truck?
650,000.
And I'm going to assume it's never had any type of maintenance to it on the EGR system and DPF.
Right. It was a truck that I got off a Low Mountain truck leasing in Tifton, Georgia, and it was traded in by a USA truck, so it was a fleet truck. It now it's commissioned to do moving furniture, so they didn't give me the history report on it. I've kept it up. I've changed the oil every 10,000 miles, and I'm on the fuel gauges, and I keep track of my fuel mileage, which is actually what let me know that I was getting poor fuel mileage. It dropped from almost 7 miles per gallon down to like almost 5, like 4.9 at one time I was at. And I just took it in to get worked on, and since they've done that uprate, and they did that program change to the torque rating during that uprate, I've experienced that grinding noise, and also I haven't seen an improvement in the fuel economy, even with the DPF replacement. So I'm kind of stumped on that, and I know that it should be getting a lot more power than what it is, considering the light loads that I'm pulling. And even on flat ground, I mean, occasionally I'll see that 7, but it has to be a perfect day. It has to be a perfect load. It has to be perfect driving conditions, 55 miles per hour. And sometimes I want to go 60, you know what I mean? And sometimes my loads are a little heavier and sometimes the weather's a little hotter. So
definitely you should do a lot better than that. We've got fellows that do with our EGR. Yeah, you know, we've done these maintenances too and done the tuning on the ISXs that are in the 7s pretty consistently, hauling a lot heavier than you haul. So that shouldn't be it. And in fact, with the 264s, you should even be able to do better than most of our people. But I'd like to get a look at the truck and like to get plugged into it and see if there's not something else going on in there that you don't know about. And the grounding noise is a concern. I mean, if you've got a mechanical issue somewhere there in the gearbox, we ought to get that straightened away first.
But all right, I'll call you guys to shop. I'll call you guys to shop and make an appointment. Like I said, I'm over here in Akron, Ohio, so it wouldn't take me but a couple hours to be there. I appreciate
you're only 2 hours away, yep. But get in here as soon as possible.
All right, let's go to New Mexico. Byron, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. I've got a 1997 Caterpillar C12 in my truck here. I've been having a little bit of issue in cold weather startups. And when it gets down below like 35, then it'll really spit and sputter and that when it first starts, and then it'll take off. And even when it gets down colder, it'll act like it's just lost fuel altogether. I was wondering if you might know what could be causing that. I've replaced all the fuel lines, checked for air loss and stuff, but I don't know how the fuel injection system works on this as far as being, chilled out when it's turned off.
Let me give that some thought. How many miles are on the engine?
2.2 million.
Okay. And
how many miles are on the injectors?
Injectors, yeah.
Oh, I've got, I think about 800,000 on the injectors.
Okay. They should be okay, but yeah, probably not the best. At 2.2 million, I've got to believe that you're a little down on compression. You've probably got a little bit more blow-by than you ought to have, and at the low cranking speeds and so forth, it's hard to get the heat of compression to light the fuel off efficiently with that kind of mileage on it. Do you have much blow-by?
I had a manometer on it?
No,
I don't have hardly any blow-by. I mean, I get no fuel in the oil, no soot. I had it rebuilt at 1.3.
Oh, okay. I thought it was 2.2, not.
Well, yeah, I should have clarified. That's on the truck.
Okay.
Sorry, I just looked down at my gauge. How many miles? Yeah, so I've got about 800,000 on the rebuild, and about 400,000 on a new cam with it.
Okay.
So.
Have
but it only happens when it gets down. Yeah, I've changed. I've got one Pittsburgh damper on it, balancer. And,
okay.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
But
about the fuel suction lines. Have you changed your fuel suction and fuel return lines?
I have, but it's been about 400,000 or 500,000 miles ago. You think that might be what the cause is?
Four or 500, they should still be okay, I think. How old?
Yeah,
I mean, how long
I
ago
agree.
Was that? What kind of time?
Pardon?
Yeah, to me, it's like a million miles or 10 years on those. So it seems that about 10 years is the useful life of a fuel line. How many years?
Yeah, I was wondering. Oh, it's been about 5 years, 4 years,
okay.
5 years.
They should be fine. So, Ethan, is there any sort of advance for cold start or anything? Could there be a problem with a sensor or something that's not telling it to?
Yeah, you'd have to get it hooked up to
fully.
A laptop.
Right.
If it's thinking the coolant temp's wrong or the intake air temp, it can definitely affect the way that's going to fuel to start in the cold.
Right, yeah. So it could be some sort of an issue with some sort of, with a cold start assist that's built into the ECM programming or some erroneous info coming from one of the sensors.
Yeah, we've seen that multiple times where a sensor fails at a certain value, and it just sits there all the time.
Yeah, but when it's up above that, you know, like, so it might just be when it gets down to those lower temperatures, it's not sending the right signal, huh?
Yeah, it's let's say the coolant temp, which is just an example there, is stuck at, 170 degrees all the time. So it thinks that the engine's warmed up already when you turn the key. And it's trying to feel for it being 170 degrees, not 35 degrees.
Ah, okay.
What
about the
example
fuel
there?
What about the fuel check valve? I've never replaced that on here. I don't. Is it in the main fuel filter housing or?
Yeah, the return valve that controls your fuel pressure. That's probably worth replacing if it's never been done.
Oh, okay.
You can check the pressure easily enough to see if that's functioning or not, though. You put a fuel pressure gauge on it.
All right, guys, that's going to wrap it up for this week. We've got to get out of here. We'll do it again next week. Thanks, John and Ethan and Bruce from Pittsburgh Power. We are all out of time. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. A general question you may be able to get through if you press 1 on your phone right now. I might be able to get to you. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, the list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call, we'll get to it here on the air. And it's one of those hour shows and the time flies by, so I'm going to try to get to as many calls as I can tonight. We're going to start off in San Diego. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Kevin, hi. Thanks for taking the call. wanted to talk
to you about
two things.
You're welcome. What can I help you with?
Thanks, man. My partner is Kevin, so we have Kevin Squared. We would have had Bruce Squared a minute ago, but just one of me.
Yeah,
at
there
this
you
point.
Go.
I want to ask you about two things. Number one, we're California-based, as you could tell by the San Diego part. We're ready to transfer from driving for a company to driving on our own, and we want to know what engine year you would recommend for us here in California is question number one. And the second part of the equation is I want to start brokering for my Kevin, and I'd like to give me some information on how to do that.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what you plan on doing. I'm assuming if you want to start brokering, you've either got some sales background or you're ready to go do some sales work.
I've been doing sales all my life.
Got it. Okay. Let's go back then, and we'll come back to the brokering part. Here's the thing
awesome.
With California. California says
yeah.
you have to have at least what they call an EPA 07 engine. Now, what that really means in the real world is the truck is probably going to need to be manufactured 08 or newer. Even though the 07 regulations are what gave us the DPF, which is what's required in California, the manufacturers had so many 07 trucks that they hadn't put DPFs on that we really didn't start seeing the DPF until the 08 trucks. The other option, and this is the option I would choose, is you can use an engine all the way back into the late 90s and install an aftermarket DPF. So that way you're only dealing with the DPF and you're not dealing with all the other emissions, the EGR and those kind of things. So, and how many miles do you, and I know you're not going to know this yet, but maybe you've got an idea. What percentage of your miles will be driven outside of California?
Probably not all that many. What we're trying to do really is establish a route maybe with Landstar to be going back and forth between here in San Diego and Mexico.
Okay.
But,
and when you say with Landstar, are you planning on getting your authority and then just using Landstar's brokerage division, or are you going to lease to Landstar?
Kevin's right here, and he says that we're planning to lease to them would be the initial thought, unless better not to.
It really depends. I mean, there's a couple ways to look at this. So if you're planning on leasing to Landstar, then you, as the sales guy, could become an agent for Landstar, which is different than brokering. Not a lot. But it's kind of like the difference between being leased to a carrier, having your own authority. You can be your own broker with your own broker's authority, meaning you can then put freight on anybody's truck, or you can be a sales agent for Landstar. Now, you're still independent. You're not a Landstar employee. But you are an agent, meaning you are using Landstar's brokerage authority, and you don't have to have your own. That is easier. Obviously, it's much easier to get set up as an agent than it is as a broker, but it also means you're giving up some of the revenue. Landstar gets their cut because you're working directly with them as an agent. So, and there's always the possibility that in the beginning, you lease the truck to Landstar, you're an agent for Landstar, and maybe somewhere down the road you do get your own authority and your own broker's authority. So it really just depends. But if you're going to spend a lot of time in California, you may want to go with the EPA 08 truck and not do the aftermarket. I'll tell you who I would talk to as you're looking to buy the truck. I would be in contact with Pittsburgh Power because they are really making some big strides in getting these these emission engines to run better, but they haven't figured out every model of every engine yet. You know, they work on one engine at a time. So if you're talking to them and you're looking at a truck, you could call them and say, hey, here's the truck we're thinking about buying. Can you keep this one running right? Can you tune it right? Can you troubleshoot it when things go wrong? And they'll let you know how far they've come on that particular engine.
Right. Okay. Now, just getting back, I don't want to take up everybody's time, but I'm looking at the ARB site, and they don't talk about EPA 08. All they talk about is the year and what the requirements are until a certain year. So I guess they're kind of trying to hide that in their own way.
Well, they're just very, very convoluted. It's a typical government-run website, and it's just confusing as all hell. But their requirement, the requirement in California right now, is the truck has to have a DPF. That's one way of simplifying this whole thing. Because if you look at their website, they've got one set of rules for a truck that's a 94 or older, another one 95 and newer. Then you get up into but basically what's mandatory right now in California is you have to have a DPF on the truck, whether it's an 08 or newer truck that had a DPF from the factory, or you take an older engine and retrofit it with an approved DPF. Those are your two options.
And therefore, Kev, that's going to meet the final requirement, quote unquote, 2010 or newer, because it's going to have a DPF.
No. See, eventually, that's the other problem. It in a couple years, and I don't try to keep all these years straight. Right now, you have to have 08 or newer technology, which means a DPF. But at some point to go into California, you are going to have what they call EPA 2010 emissions, which included the selective catalytic reduction using the DEF diesel exhaust fluid. But that's not a requirement yet. I forget what year that kicks in. But then after that, the trucks pre-emission with DPFs aren't going to work. So you've got to look at this, you know, a little more long-term possibly. Although I think it's like 2020 something before we've got to worry about having the 2010 emissions. So I think you're better
right.
off. Yeah, I think you're better off going with the minimum amount of emissions for now. Because if you keep a truck 2 or 3 or 4 years, it's easy to go out and replace it anyway. So if it were me and I had to go to California, I would be building a glider and retrofitting it with a DPF. Or I would be buying a used glider and retrofitting it with a DPF.
I was just asking you. I was just thinking about the Schneider gliders that you've been talking about. Will they qualify for California at this time?
Not the way they're sitting there. So let's say that's a $40,000 truck or so. You're going to have to spend another $15,000 to $20,000 to make that truck California compliant. But that would be my choice. I would do that before I would buy an 08 or newer truck.
And that we could get done at Pittsburgh Power.
Yes, I don't know if they have their final DPF solution yet. I know they've been working on one. They've just been trying to find a company to partner with. There are companies that will do the DPF. Pittsburgh Power has been trying to work with somebody and become an installer of a specific DPF. I don't know if they figured it out yet or not. So that's what I would do on the truck side. Or you just buy 08 or newer. Anything 08 or newer will qualify for California for a couple more years. Let me get to a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the broker agent side of this question right after this. Stick around. We'll be right back with more of your calls and questions. I'm Kevin Rutherford. welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. And I'm going to go right back to the phones. I was talking with Bruce in San Diego. So, Bruce, going back to the business side of this, whether or not your question originally was how to become a freight broker, and maybe in the beginning, all you're really going to become is an agent. And as far as becoming an agent of Landstar, doesn't really require a whole lot on your part. There's no kind of licensing or bonding or any of that like you would as a broker. You become a sales agent, an independent sales agent for Landstar. So you would go out and beat on doors and find freight to move, but you would move all of your freight under Landstar's umbrella. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. Right.
Or you could become a freight broker yourself, and then you can move freight on anybody's trucks, not just under Landstar system. And you would then control how much of the revenue from each load you get to keep. And what you have to do there is, one, you have to go out and get your broker's authority, which is no big deal. It's just paperwork and money. I mean, you just apply for it, you go through and then in this case, you would also get your carrier's authority. So if you're going to just go completely independent with this truck, you would get your carrier's authority. That means you can haul anybody's freight anywhere you want, and you get all the revenue. And you could get your broker's authority at the same time. That way, if you go out to a shipper, and let's say that shipper has 5 loads a week and they want to give you all 5 and you can't handle that with your trucks, you can say, okay, I'm going to take these 3 every week because I really like them. And with your broker's authority, you could then move the rest of the freight on anybody else's truck.
Gotcha.
And on the broker side, the way it would work, let's say you go into the shipper, you sell them, they give you all 5 loads, and let's say the load is paying you $225 a mile. Then it's your job as the broker to put that load on a truck and make sure it gets delivered. And it would be you negotiating, you know, maybe you can move it for $1.75 a mile. And then as the broker, you keep the other 50 cents a mile for selling and booking the freight.
Right. No, that I completely understand that part. The main reason for me wanting to do this is because I'm trying to broker for my partner probably as close to 100% of the time as I can. So maybe it's not for the income side so much. And so maybe you're onto something more than I am as far as Landstar is concerned in trying to coordinate with them and our situation at the start anyway.
Right.
Or
yeah. Landstar gives you the option for on both sides. You can lease the truck to them and you can become an agent for them. So you can go out and find some of your own freight. And again, if you're the agent and you have a truck at Landstar, you can kind of cherry pick. When you go out and sell the best freight, you don't even post that for anybody else. You just put it on your truck. But anything else you sell, you can post into the Landstar system, and then you get a piece of it for selling the freight, even if your truck never moves it.
Does an agent for Landstar get to see the boards before other people do?
You have different access to. Yeah, it's not necessarily that you see it before anybody else, but you have different access to it because obviously you have the ability to post loads into the system, whereas a BCO or a truck owner only has the ability to see loads, not to post them.
Right. I've been on the Landstar site and I saw where I didn't research as much as you've given me the ability to do so. So it gives us a lot to work with. That's super.
Well, there you go. And if you have any other questions, give me a call back. Let's go to South Carolina. Ron, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I got a question about the 18 speed versus the 13 speed. You guys were talking about it. I understand the gear ratios are all the same. I've got a 600 horsepower cat, and my differentials are huge. They're bigger than just a regular, you know, truck. Mine got the oversized differentials. And I was told, and I thought I looked it up in the specs, that because of the 600 cat that I have, I need the 18 speed because it has a higher torque rating than the 13 speed.
That is correct. And you have 23,000 pound differentials. Most trucks have 20,000 pounds. Where you see the 23,000 pound a lot is if you see the trucks that are single axle pulling doubles or triples. So in a single axle, they tend to use that 23,000 pound differential, or in a heavy haul operation, whereas everybody else using 20,000 pounds. Here's the thing about torque rating. If you were to go build a new truck and the engine torque exceeds the 13s, they will only build that truck with an 18 speed. We're just of the opinion, and Bruce and John and everybody at Pittsburgh Power agrees with me, that all of the ratings are really, really conservative. Like, I would have no problem taking a transmission that's rated for 1,600 foot-pounds of torque and putting an engine with 2,000 foot-pounds of torque and driving it. Wouldn't bother me a bit. I could make that transmission last just as long. Now, on the other hand, I would never take a new driver and put him in that truck. He's going to tear something up. So, yeah, the 18 speed is higher rated as far as torque. But if it were me, I would put the highest torque rated 13 speed I could put in there, and I it wouldn't bother me a bit. We've been overpowering drivetrains, transmissions, and differentials for decades. With a good driver, you just don't see a problem with it.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Tennessee. Billy, welcome to the program.
Hello?
It's your turn. Go ahead.
I really had a question for Pittsburgh Power, but you can probably answer it, Kevin. I was just wondering, I'm considering buying a new truck with a Cummins in it, and I'd heard you guys talking about that Bruce and M's doing some after treatment, not necessarily upgrades, but they got a particular way of maintaining them that is maybe making them work out better for everybody. Could you shed some light on that, maybe?
Yeah, I can. So they've done a lot of work on the emission engines to figure out. Because, and I've said this for years, when the emission engines run right, they're pretty amazing. I mean, we get good fuel economy, good power, everything. The problem is sometimes they never run right. Sometimes they run right for a while and then they start screwing up and nobody seems to know how to fix them. They really took a lot of time to figure out what goes wrong and how to fix it. And what they've identified are a certain group of sensors that cause problems and the fact that we get a lot of soot built up in the entire emission system. So they've developed a maintenance procedure where they go through, they take the emission system apart, they clean out all the soot, they replace the sensors that cause the problems, even if they're not faulty yet, at 250,000 miles, not that expensive, and that tends to keep everything running right. And they're having a lot of, plus they have some of their own tuning on the ECM that makes them produce more horsepower, more torque, get better fuel economy, better throttle response. So their whole package really seems to be working well on these emission engines, even to the point where I'm starting to come around that maybe I would own one of these engines
if I have the ability to let them maintain it.
Okay. And one other question. I just was listening to them today on your show today that they're getting some people scattered out in different corners. That, is it going to be just similar to maybe like the MD alignment, the way they got their system set up where you can go maybe to a shop in, say, for instance, California, and they'll do the MD alignment. Is this going to be kind of like you can go to a shop in other states and get the same
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. So Pittsburgh Power created the software, created the program, created the laptops, they do the training, and they will also support the other shop. So let me get to a break. I'll come back and I'll talk about that a little bit more. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. So Pittsburgh Power's new program, really, really exciting. So Pittsburgh Power has some amazing electrical engineers. They've figured out a lot about tuning and tweaking and troubleshooting in the ECMs. And what they're able to do, because this is all ECM related, is they're able to do this remotely. So they are going out. They've developed a software package, a laptop, a whole bundle, and they also do the training. So T&E, one of our favorite shops in Kansas City, is one of the first shops that have this capability. So Pittsburgh Power set T&E up with the hardware, software bundle, and the training so that you pull in. They plug in with Berg Power's bundle. You pull into T&E in Kansas City, and there's a good chance that right there with the laptop and the software, they'll figure it out. But if they run into a problem where maybe they don't have enough experience on, the cool thing about this is all they do is pick up the phone, call Pittsburgh Power. One of the engineers from Pittsburgh Power logs in remotely and can troubleshoot your truck remotely. So really exciting to see this happening. And they're getting some shops set up around the country. We're working with them to help set up some of our favorite shops. And again, T&E in Kansas City is the first one. So we kind of made that analogy between MD Alignment. They do the same thing. They created the hardware, the equipment, they do the training, and then you can get that same type of MD alignment in different parts of the country. Well, T&E happens to be partners with Alignment Solutions, Chad. So you pull into T&E in Kansas City. Now, not only can you get Pittsburgh Power's tuning and diagnostic and troubleshooting, but you can also get Chad and MD Alignment. So T&E right there in the middle of the country, becoming a great, great resource for us. Let's go to South Carolina. Devin, welcome to the program.
Mr. Rutherford, how you doing? I'm not a truck driver, but I love listening to your show. You give good information. I give you a couple of questions here, and then I'll listen for your comment. I know you like the N14, the Cat 6NZ, and the 12.7. Why can't you get those trucks, those engines in today's trucks? Is it an EPA problem? And do they still manufacture those engines since they run so well?
So, yes, it is an EPA thing. Back in, starting in 2004,
the EPA started mandating certain standards in engines. So in 2004, we had new standards. In 2007, we had newer standards. 2010, the standards got more strict. And again, we're going to have them next year in 2017, even new standards. So those engines had to keep changing over time. And the problem is every time we got a new standard, we got a whole bunch of new maintenance problems. That's why I don't like those engines, because they have maintenance problems. We're finally starting to figure out, that's what I was just talking about with Pittsburgh Power. They're finally starting to figure out how to fix some of those problems. But one of the ways to avoid it is just don't buy one of these new engines. Buy the older. The three you mentioned are my favorites, the N14, the Series 60, and the 6NZ Cat. They don't necessarily manufacture those engines anymore, but they still manufacture all the parts to rebuild those engines. And that's what we keep doing. We just keep taking the block and rebuilding it to keep them running. And for now, that's still my preferred strategy. Rebuild the older engines. I'm starting to come around to the idea, if Pittsburgh Power can figure out these engines and keep them running right, that may change the game.
Now, if you had a choice and there was nothing left, what engine would you buy if it had to be an emission engine?
It would be, hands down, it would be the DD15, the Detroit, or a DD13, either one.
Good enough. Kevin, I thank you for your time. Thank you today. Have a good day.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Utah. Terry, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's on your
Hello?
Mind today?
Yes, I am calling because I'm considering buying a truck, and I'm trying to find out when I'm looking at an engine, and I know I can go get a dyno. Some of them already have dyno reports on them when you go to the dealers. When I'm not looking through a dealer, I don't have that. What can I look for? I'm not a mechanic. I'm a driver. What do I need to look for on those engines when I'm out there looking before I spend the money to take it to a dyno? Because I'm always going to dyno it before I make a purchase. So is there a place where I can find information that will help me understand exactly what it is I'm looking at on those engines and transmissions before, as I'm out there looking myself?
There isn't a lot of information anywhere. In the program that I wrote about getting started, which covers everything about getting started, not just the truck, it covers, you know, business setup and
Correct.
Budgeting and find the right truck, finding the right carrier, all of that stuff. There is a chapter about finding the right
that.
Truck.
Yeah. And I have
so if
I've,
you look there,
I've got your system, so
good. So if you look through there, there's a chapter where I explain how to read the ECM report on I think we explained the CAT and the Detroit. I don't think we explained any of the other engines, but it's similar. So here's kind of the things that I like to see when I'm going to buy used trucks. Number one, I always want a rig dig report. The rig dig report is going to give us a lot of history about that truck, who's owned it, every time it's been on the roadside or at a scale or anywhere. We're going to get all the results of that inspection. If it's ever been in an accident, if the title's ever been altered or modified in any way, if it's ever had an insurance claim on it, all of that information shows up on a rig dig report. So for $30 All right. or whatever they cost, you just can't beat that. That's always step number one. Then if the rig dig report looks good, and remember, when I buy a used truck, I'm looking all over the country. I'm not just looking in my backyard. In fact, I would highly recommend you not
Correct.
Look in your backyard. You got to look everywhere.
Correct.
So now if I find the truck, let's say it's six states away, the rig dig report looks good. I call the dealer. I say, hey, can you pull an ECM report on this truck and email it to me? And if they can't, I move on.
I mean, if they're not willing to go pull an ECM report and get it to me, then I just move on. There are lots of dealers that will do it. So in the ECM report, okay, I can see things like idle percentage, which is important, over speeds, average speed, fuel economy. There's a lot of good information, heartbreaking data. There's a lot of good information in there. If I happen to be looking at an 08 or newer truck that has a DPF, there will also be information in there about the regens, which is a really important piece. If we see that an engine is regenning a lot, that means it's got some emission problems. We may want to avoid that. So rig dig first, ECM second. If I'm buying from a dealer, unfortunately, the dealers change the oil on the truck as soon as they get them. It's standard. They all do
correct
it. So now that eliminates being able to pull an oil sample. But I'll tell you what I've done in the past. I build a relationship with a truck dealer, and I call them, and I say, instead of me looking all over the country, I sit down with the sales guy that I have a relationship with, and I say, here's what I want. And I might be real specific. I want a 99 Volvo. I want a 12.7 Detroit. I want a 13-speed. Really don't care about anything else. Meet those requirements. And I want you to find the truck before they change the oil. So if they're out looking at auctions, then my instructions to them are, when you find this truck, let me know, but do not change the oil. Do not service this truck. So I've worked with dealers in the past to be able to get that oil sample before they ever get the truck in and process it, change the oil. So those are some things we'd like to look for. If I could go beyond that, then I would love to take the truck to somebody like Pittsburgh Power and put it on the dyno, because we can check horsepower, we can check a lot of ECM settings, we can check blow-by so we know the condition of the rings and cylinders. That would be the ultimate, if I could do all of those things I just outlined. But it's not, it doesn't mean I have to do all those things. That's what I'd really like to be able to do. Let me get to a break. We'll come right back with more stuff. All right, we've got one more segment to record, and I can probably squeeze in another call or possibly two. So if you have a question, a comment, a topic, press one on your phone real quick, and I might be able to get to you. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get to the phone calls. We're going to head off to California. Gramit, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Doing great. What can I help you with today?
Can you hear me? I have an oil sample for you to look at.
All right, let's take a look. So we've got an ISX. What engine is it? Or what year, I mean?
It's the 2012 emission.
2012. We've got, just verify for me here, about 730,000 miles on the engine and 25,000 miles on this oil. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This is actually a really, really good sample for an ISX. You have no fuel dilution. Very, very low soot, which is really good to see on an ISX. Your soot is at 0.4. That's excellent for this engine. Viscosity is just about perfect. Base is holding up okay. No oxidation or nitration. Wear metals are really, really low. There's no dirt. There's no coolant. I don't know what else to say. This is just a great oil sample. So I think you've got an ISX that's running really well.
Yeah, on that additives, Kevin, is showing magnesium jumped like a 49. Is it something to do with the engine, right? It's the additive in the oil, I think.
Yeah, let me take a look. So what you see there is the magnesium. And if you're looking at the oil sample, and if we're looking at those categories across the top, you've got wear metals, that's a group. Then you've got contaminant metals, that's a group. We always look at those. Those are important. We will find problems in there. Then you go to multi-source metals. You can ignore those. And then after that, you have additive metals. You can ignore those. Honestly, I wish they would just take those two categories off the oil sample. I've been reading oil samples over 20 years now, and I have never had a single oil sample where either one of those categories mattered. All they ever do is confuse people. So the magnesium, what happens is magnesium is an additive. Some oils use a lot of magnesium. Some oils use a little bit of magnesium. Some oils use none. But even the same oil sometime has very different amounts. And so the lab will flag it because it's not what they expect to see, but it just doesn't mean anything. I mean, like I say, in 20 years, I have never paid any attention to what's in those two blocks.
Okay. Alrighty, sounds
Thanks
good.
For
you
the
think,
call.
Is it?
Yep. Great. Great sample. Things are looking good in there. Keep doing what you're doing. Let's go to Nevada. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Can a truck's engine develop basically altitude sickness?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it can, because a diesel engine is very, very sensitive to air flow and air concentration. You know, we always say we want more and more cold, dense air in the engine. In fact, we can't ever get enough. You know, that's why we have turbochargers. That's why we have charger coolers. That's why we watch boost. That's what makes a diesel engine run so good, is lots and lots of cold, dense air. And the higher you go in altitude, the thinner and thinner the air gets. So just by their nature, diesel engines don't run as well at altitude. But the cool thing about electronics is electronics are able to make up for that change. So an electronic engine handles, you know, going from sea level up to 10,000 feet a whole lot better than a mechanical engine did. Just like fuel injection is way better when you change altitudes than carburation. So
if I'm having an issue, it's probably a computer issue then.
Computer or sensor, more than likely. And honestly, it's probably going to be a sensor issue feeding the computer the wrong information when you get up to altitude.
Because if you want to listen, if I can try to explain this, I have a 99 International with a N14 Plus. I've only been on the road with it under my own authority since last month. Everything's been running great. I have no modifications to it as of yet. I had a maxed out load, like 79.8, that I had to take across the Vail Pass. And, you know, it was a long, slow, typical climb up Vail, but then once I got to the top, I had no power. I pulled over and stopped. I was checking what I could. I looked at the air cleaner, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, at some point, I figured out that I could get it going, but I had to stay in the low RPM range, like, you know, 1,200 to 1,400 RPMs max, which means I was lugging it every time I had to upshift. Once I got back down to, like, Denver, it was running better, but I was still having issues at a little higher RPMs. And now it's intermittent. Sometimes it runs great. I do my progressive shifting, usually between, you know, 1,500 and 1,700 RPMs. But other times, like today, just driving across Nevada, it's kind of limiting me to 1,500, and it's even dropped a little bit lower than that at point. And then when I stopped, shut it off, turned it back on again, and went going again, it still had the issue, but it was at a higher RPM level. Does that sound anything like something you've heard before?
Yeah, and that really does sound electronic. You know, sometimes what you're describing could be nothing more than a fuel filter. The engine just won't, just doesn't get enough fuel to produce any boost. If it doesn't produce boost, it can't produce horsepower. So sometimes you can have that kind of power or altitude issue with just nothing more than a clogged fuel filter. But the way you're okay. describing it, where it's not very consistent, it's almost intermittent, that sounds to me like it is yeah. more electronic. So more than likely it's a sensor. This is one of those issues where, unfortunately, a lot of shops just aren't very good at finding these kind of things. I've seen a cam sensor cause this. There are several sensors that could cause this, but you just want to get it to somebody that's good at troubleshooting that kind of stuff.
Unfortunately, I live in Southwest Washington, so what do you suggest? I mostly run the West also, so it's going to be a while before
yeah,
I ever get to Pittsburgh Power.
Yeah, I don't have any really strong recommendations. In fact, I don't have any shop recommendations up in the Pacific Northwest, even though I live there now. I just haven't found anybody that I'm really wild about. Okay. Talking to Pittsburgh Power today, they did say that they are currently setting up a shop somewhere in Washington to be able to do the remote tuning and troubleshooting. So what I would do is I would call Pittsburgh Power and find out who that is.
Yeah, okay. God, I hope it's not Husky. They're terrible. Anyway.
Now, right. You know, Pittsburgh Power is pretty good at you know, knowing what shops they've worked with people around the country in the past. So they're pretty good at, you know, finding a good quality shop that's going to represent them well. So I would do that because this is one of those things that is perfect for their new remote tuning. This would be the ideal because they plug in, you're in Washington, they're able to look at your ECM from Pittsburgh, even though your truck's in Washington, and really kind of help the shop troubleshoot it, figure out what's going on. Let's go to Tennessee. Rulon, welcome to the program.
Hello. I have a 99 Freightliner.
Okay.
And I was wondering about single wide. It's a straight truck. If the
okay.
two-inch offset
what's the question?
Would work on that.
Oh, the you know, I would not
light.
Go with the Yeah, I wouldn't go with the two-inch. There are some light operations where it does tend to work, but this is also a single axle, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so I would still go with the zero offset or the two-inch offset, but flip the rim around the other way, which creates like a three-quarter of an inch offset, which is a little bigger than the zero, but quite a bit smaller than the zero. We've just found that rather than take the chance and find out the two-inch is going to cause the problem, just go with the zero or take the two and flip them around the other way. And then you're assured you're not going to have any problems with it at all. So that's the way I would do it. The music's playing. That means I am all out of time. I've got to get out of here. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. We'll see you next time. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow for Destination Health. Thanks. See you then.